From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. I want to thank you for being with us today and wish you a happy Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, and happy Thanksgiving, everybody. On this weekend, traditionally dedicated to food, family, and football, we're going to take a look at some of the things so many of us can feel grateful for and some essential ways we can and should share our bounty with less fortunate people around the world. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. We're very thankful for you and for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Only a month after cuts to the federal food stamp program called SNAP took effect, food banks are already hearing from people who just can't afford enough to eat.
The cuts impact 47 million Americans, including 22 million children on food stamps and 9 million elderly or seriously disabled people.
Sure. Thanksgiving is a holiday long associated with food, too much food in many cases. But what about the millions of Americans living with food insecurity, especially after the cuts to the SNAP program at the start of this month? No, this won't be a segment just to make you feel guilty. That's not our mission. But we will look at how much more dire the situation has become for many, as well as at one program in particular working to help, when I'm joined by Jennifer Bailey of Community Food Advocates in Nashville, Tennessee.
Foreign aid, we should get rid of foreign aid and don't have it anymore, because all foreign aid is bribery.
Yeah, I understand sort of the source of frustration, but I think it's important to remember we spend 1% of our total budget on foreign aid.
At a time when the federal budget has become a national obsession, and essential domestic aid to the less fortunate is under constant attack, it might be easy to dismiss foreign aid as simply being beyond our means. But as with so many things, there is more to the story than just the headlines. In this case, the story is one of success and effectiveness, particularly when it comes to children in the third world countries. And we'll hear some of the story on this week's show when I'm joined by the Reverend David Beckman, who has a long history of firsthand knowledge of the impact that U.S. aid has on the world. But first,
the only way to make sure immigration reform works this time is to address these complicated issues one step at a time.
For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that they weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert.
The United States has been shaped by immigrants.
Hospitality, a place at the table. When I was a stranger, you took me in. All of these words resonate with many, perhaps most, Americans. Yet a Congress that professes to be steeped in Christian morality, not that I'm saying that's a good thing, can't seem to manage to act on one of the most fundamental expressions of all of these values, immigration reform. And so an estimated 11 million people head into this holiday season with no more security than they felt last year at this same time, despite progress in the United States Senate. I'm joined now by Dr. Miguel de la Torre, professor of social ethics and Latino studies, a public speaker, prolific writer, and author of numerous books, the latest of which is Liberation Theology for Armchair Theologians. Miguel, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
I am so glad to be with you, mainly because the greatest human rights violation that is occurring in the United States today is occurring in our borders.
You put it right on the table up front. And so it's Thanksgiving weekend, but still there's no place at the table for so many who consider this country to be their home. Miguel, what in the world is it going to take?
It has taken over a century to get into the mess we are in now. It may take another century to fix it. Our immigration problem did not just occur yesterday. It began with our foreign policy in Latin America, known as gunboat diplomacy, in the turn of the last century. And our economic policies, i.e. NAFTA, that is pushing thousands upon thousands, if not millions upon millions of people out of their countries towards the United States.
In public opinion, that people listen to our members of Congress talking about religion, speaking about their faith, but diverse faith leaders, business leaders, and others are all supporting reform, but these politicians seem not to be listening. Is that the way you see it?
Well, I think many of the politicians are afraid that if these immigrants become citizens, they may be voting more liberal and more socially conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a fear of the changing demographics in this nation and the power that comes with these new demographics voting. So for many of these politicians, no, they do not want to bring about change. Plus, many of the laws that have been passed has been funded by private prison corporations that are making billions of dollars by making sure that we have a broken immigration system in where immigrants go to jail.
I want you to say a little more about that, because you're bringing up something that doesn't usually get pointed to in this discussion. And if I am hearing you right, there is a profit motive for these private prisons involved here.
Absolutely. The major private corporations that are prisons charge the government. If my, let's see, back in 2009, they were charging the government like $112 per prisoner per day, while their cost to maintain a prisoner was like $24, $25. Mm. So the profit margin is very high, and because the undocumented do not take have the same prison rights or the same rights as U.S. citizens, there's no oversight. So there's tremendous abuses going on. But it is very profitable. So it's not surprising that these same prison companies are spending money in campaign contributions and in writing laws that create things like Operation Streamline, which is a judicial process that ensures that the undocumented, when caught, actually goes to prison.
Yeah.
So it's a profit-making operation in where, of course, the undocumented is the ones who are suffering the most.
Miguel, how do you think we ought to relate to legislators? I just mentioned that so many of these people identify themselves as people of faith and they speak religious language. I don't know how they can justify in action for themselves and how they justify it to their constituents. What's the best way to call their hand on it?
That's a good question, and we need to be careful with religious language, because many times we use the language of hospitality, that as good Christians, we should be hospitable to these strangers. But the problem with hospitality is that it assumes I own the house, and out of the goodness of my heart, I'm going to let you live in my house.
Mm.
The reality is that the reason we have an immigration problem today is because for a century, we conducted regime change throughout Central America and the Caribbean, overturning governments to a tune of 46 regime change in the last century. In order to protect U.S. business of having the goods, services flow towards the United States. Add to that the recent NAFTA agreement, in where, for example, we spent $41.9 billion in subsidizing crops and corn in the first 10 years of NAFTA, meaning that farmers could no longer compete against corn. It was cheaper to buy U.S. corn than to grow it, forcing close to 1.7 million farmers losing their farms due to NAFTA. So you have this massive push of immigrants out of their former home because of our trade policies, and because of the wars and violence that we've created in Latin America. So the real question is, when one country builds roads into another country to extract their raw material and their cheap labors, why should we be surprised that those same people take those same roads following everything that has been stolen from them?
Mm.
So the question is no longer hospitality. It is their cheap resources and labors that built the house. So maybe we should be talking about restitution. But that's a conversation politicians and many Americans are not willing to have.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe in human terms the toll that this takes on families and communities, and especially during this holiday season?
Let me give you the example of Jocelyn. Jocelyn is a 12-year-old girl who her mother came to the United States, and after many years, she went ahead and decided to follow her mother. On her way here, she had a sprained ankle while crossing the desert. That's a death sentence. The organization I work with, No More Deaths, found her body. She died of thirst and hunger in the desert. The toll in human life is tens of thousands of people who are literally disappearing on the borders. Little girls like Jocelyn. And here's the moral question. In the richest country the world has ever known, we have a 12-year-old girl dying of thirst. There is something morally wrong with that picture.
Absolutely. It is. I mean, I have to ask, do you think that members of Congress are aware of those kinds of tragic stories?
Absolutely. We always have this thing about you need to speak truth to power.
Right.
I believe power already knows the truth. Hmm. They have the GAO studies. They have the Border Patrol studies. They know what's going on. What we need to do is speak truth to the powerless to hold those with power in Congress accountable to the rhetoric that they seem to be claiming that we're a nation that welcomes immigrants and that we have open arms.
Miguel, I should tell you that my graduate studies were in ethics, so I have a great appreciation for your work in ethics. And just from the perspective of an ethicist as well as a great human being, how can we realign our public policies with what we at least confess to be our private values?
That's a very difficult question, because once we begin to do that, that means we begin to change how power structures operate. And those who are being privileged by our present power structures are not willing to give up that power. So we see all kinds of shenanigans going on, like, voter ID, and disenfranchise many of the voters. Sometimes probably the only thing that we can do is to mess with the system, to actually begin to protest the inhumanity, the human rights violations that are going on at the border. Not since the days of Jim Crow do we have policies on the books that deter one group of people through the usage of death in the desert to prevent the same group of people from doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's unacceptable, and immoral at the very least.
I'm intrigued by the title of your new book, Liberation Theology for Armchair Theologians. Haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I wish you would talk about the idea behind that book.
Well, basically the book was written to individuals who may not know much about liberation theology. So it does the historical background. But then what I try to do is I move beyond just Christianity and show liberation theology and how it operates among people who are Buddhists, among people who are Jewish, who are Muslims, who are Hindu, and who are humanists.
Mm-hmm.
And how by us all working towards social justice, what all of our different faith traditions calls us to do, we can become ecumenical. We can actually have conversation without giving up the tenets of our individual faith.
Right.
And quite frankly, I really believe that the greatest threat to humanity today is the globalization of the economy, also known as neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that could stand against this oppressive structure are the faith traditions of the people who really believe in the calling of standing in solidarity with the very least of these.
Yeah. So you already are headed in that direction. Say a little more about the role that liberation theology plays in dealing with today's social justice issues, both in this country and beyond.
Well, the basic tenet of liberation theology is to stand with the oppressed, to stand with the poor, to stand with the hungry and the thirsty and the naked. When we do that, we then have new eyes by which to understand how the divine operates in our lives and within our world. So what liberation theology does for me and for many other individuals is that it brings our faith alive, because our faith truly comes alive when we do our faith rather than just believe in it or talk about it. It's a radical understanding of Christianity that, in my opinion, just brings it alive. So that's what excites me about it, and I think that's one of the reasons why I've written these type of books.
I think it'd be safe to say that if you sit down in an armchair to read liberation theology, pretty soon you got to get up.
It's funny you say that, because the very last paragraph of the book, you know, of spoiler alert, is asking the reader that it's time to put down the book and literally get out of your armchair, because if you don't, then you know nothing about liberation theology. Which, going back to immigration, I would double dog dare your readers to come down to the border for themselves,
mm-hmm.
to come feed the hungry, come give water to the thirsty, come clothe the naked. And if they see for themselves the human rights violations that are occurring there, it would evangelize, it would spiritualize, it would revolutionize their entire faith.
What a great challenge. Dr. Miguel Della Torre is professor of social ethics and Latino studies in Denver, Colorado. His latest book is Liberation Theology for Armchair Theologians. Miguel, I am so glad that you are helping educate and train ministers for the next generation. You are so right on. And thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
And thank you very much, and thank you for the work you're doing on this radio station.
Later in the show, David Beckman of Bread for the World on the mandate for people of faith to speak out in support of U.S. foreign aid programs. As the holiday season gets underway, many of us are fortunate to be wallowing in abundance. At the same time, the growth in the number of public aid recipients signals a deeply disturbing trend, one that's been made worse by cuts to SNAP and other government programs at the start of this month. Joining me right now is Jennifer Bailey. Jennifer works as the Food Stamp Outreach Specialist at Community Food Advocates in Nashville, Tennessee. Jennifer, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have chosen to work in a very direct way with people in need, so you're the right one to ask, what impact are you seeing from the cuts of November 1st?
Great question. It's interesting. As I think about the cuts that recently happened on November 1st, I don't think about statistics. I think about stories.
Good.
Over the past couple of weeks, I've gotten a number of calls, and one day that really stood out to me is just before the cuts happened, about 2 days before, I got a call from two mothers. The first was, I'll call Miss Williams. She was a mother of two young children, lived happily with her husband, and they started a business after college. And that business, unfortunately, in the 2008 financial crisis failed. And so for the past couple of years, they've really gone through their savings and attempted to find jobs, but in this economy haven't been able to find those positions that would allow them to sustain their family. Mm-hmm. Now, if I told you the neighborhood that Ms. Williams lives in, you would never believe me that there is hunger behind her doors.
Hmm.
But, you know, I got a call from her basically asking for help, saying, I only have ramen noodles and peanut butter to feed my family tonight.
Mm. Mm.
And I think her story is so indicative of what's happening, mm-hmm. right? The face of hunger in the United States is more than often a child, yeah. right? Or a yeah. person or family living with children, or an elderly person, or someone that's permanently disabled. The second woman who called me, I'll call Ms. Martinez. She is a single mother of two daughters, working 40 hours a week. Her husband had passed away, so she decided to relocate from Atlanta here to Nashville as a way of healing, actually, getting away from some of the pain of that death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a woman who works, again, 40 hours a week to support her two daughters and actually makes more than the allotted amount for food stamps. But because one of her daughters, her eldest daughter, who's a teenager, is ill right now, most of her income goes towards paying for the bare necessities and her daughter's medical costs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it was a call that was very much about the desperation. I need food immediately or else my daughters won't eat tonight. Those are the faces of hunger that I see when I hear folks on, you know, the television and on the radio talking about food stamp recipients or folks who are hungry as mm-hmm. takers of the system rather yeah. than those who really are trying to make it and just need that extra help and support to get them through a short period of time.
To be completely blunt, some people were forced to cancel Thanksgiving dinner?
I think so. I mean, for a lot of folks who rely on food stamp benefits, now, you know, a cut for a family of four, the maximum cut, was up to $36. And while that might not sound like a lot to some of us, that's a good portion of someone's Thanksgiving meal.
Yeah, yeah. Jennifer, what does it say about our society that food security is not an absolute national priority?
Well, it says that we have other priorities that have taken precedent over caring for those folks who are least among us. I was recently ordained a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church and have thought a lot about, for me, coming from my own faith background,
mm-hmm.
what it means to provide for the least of these, and recognizing that I am one paycheck away from being one of the least of these, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it speaks to even faith institutions who are engaged in food security work, for example, really embrace a charity-based model, which is important. People need to get fed immediately. And as the holiday season commences, we'll see plenty of turkey drives and community dinners. But
sure.
the unfortunate reality is that ending hunger is going to require more than a meal. It's going to require that faith-based institutions and broader social agencies get engaged in policy reforms on both the local, state, and national
yeah.
levels.
What do you think it will take to realign our national priorities to better reflect our individual consciences and compassion?
I think it's about getting the story of those who are hungry out there, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. You know, because, and I want you to elaborate on that, but I don't know anybody that does not have enough compassion to say, I don't want anybody in my neighborhood, in my town, in my city to go hungry. But then there's not a follow-up of that to make sure that doesn't happen.
Right. And I think that's where the role of first telling those narratives, so the narratives of, you know, the families that I was describing to you earlier become so important.
Mm.
Again, those are families, those are our neighbors, those are our aunties, our uncles, our grandmothers, the people who sit next to us in the pews every day. But because we've developed such a culture of shame around asking for assistance in our country, we really love the idea of pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
Mm.
We forget that to truly build beloved community, as Dr. Martin Luther King talks about, it involves us being mutually intertwined and seeing the problems and issues my neighbor is facing as my own. And I think you're right that there is a deep-seated compassion. I personally don't know anyone who would say that children should starve. But unfortunately, we start to see these issues in silos, right?
Right.
So hunger, for example, is a symptom of poverty and economic injustice in a real way, and lack of job opportunities in certain communities. But if we just see hunger as I'm going to, again, give somebody a meal at a soup kitchen and feel good about myself, but not ask the hard question of why they're hungry, then I really don't think we can get to the root of ending food insecurity in our nation.
Right. Jennifer, please, if you would, talk about Community Food Advocates, something of the organization's history and the services that you provide in Nashville.
Absolutely. So Community Food Advocates, I like to say we're a small organization with a big mission, which is to end hunger and create a healthy, just, and sustainable food system here in Middle Tennessee. We formed in 2009 from the merger of two existing nonprofit organizations, MANA Incorporated, which was the oldest anti-hunger organization in the state of Tennessee and was responsible for bringing programs like the school breakfast program and school lunch program to our community, and the Food Security Partners of Middle Tennessee, which was really an alliance of farmers and other stakeholders who are interested in seeing our food system have a more sustainable impact in our community. Currently, we run three different programs. My program, SNAP Outreach and Advocacy, which goes out into communities and helps folks sign up for the SNAP program. Primarily, I work with the most vulnerable among us, so that's homeless individuals, individuals who are seniors and living with disabilities, immigrants and refugees, the recently incarcerated. And the group that we find ourselves working with most with are the population we call the new poor or the working poor.
Yeah.
So folks who had never had to access the benefits system before, but because they, you know, don't have the income coming in that they once did, now find themselves relying on these special safety net programs.
Mm-hmm.
We also run a program called SNAP Fresh, which seeks to connect SNAP recipients, and SNAP is the federal name for the food stamp program, with local farmers markets. And we see that as a true win-win, both for local agriculture, increasing the clientele of our local farmers, and for SNAP recipients who are often the residents of food desert communities. So those are areas with little or no access to affordable, healthy foods.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we work with a program called Growing Healthy Kids, which works here in Nashville to improve the quality of nutrition in our school cafeterias. In Metro Nashville Public Schools, over 72% of children receive free or reduced lunch, which means, you know, the school meal that they get might be the only healthy meal they get throughout the day.
Mm.
But if you'd like to find out more about our organization, I would invite you to visit our blog at www.communityfoodadvocate.org/blog. And you will find a lot of really interesting information about what's going on here in the state of Tennessee to combat hunger. www.communityfoodadvocate.org/blog. And there you'll find information about all of our programs and connections to national organizations who are also doing really great work in this area.
Jennifer, I know there are some innovative initiatives underway, this Restoring Nashville, the Vegetarian Project. Talk a minute about those.
Yeah, so Restoring Nashville is a program that CFA launched back in 2009 to address the problem of food deserts in the greater Nashville community. Now, food deserts are areas, again, with little or no access to affordable, healthy, fresh food. So as part of that initiative, we really were working to mobilize faith communities as advocates and supporters, primarily around three areas. One, improving the quality of corner stores in existing communities. I know being from the south side of Chicago, the corner store was sort of a staple in my neighborhood, but it often didn't have healthy foods. It had chips and pop and other staples but for junk food, but nothing really healthy. So part of that initiative was looking to improve the quality of those stores. Second, to increase transportation to and from local grocery stores. And I can tell you a quick story about a woman named Miss Debbie who lived in one of these communities. She was an elderly lady in her 70s, and she To get to the grocery store, which is only a mile away, because of the way our transportation system is set up here, and Nashville. She had to get on one bus that took her downtown, then another bus that would take her all the way out to the grocery store, which was just down the street. And a round trip would take up to 3 hours to get to the grocery store and back just to get her staple items. So one of the efforts of restoring Nashville was to advocate for better transportation lines to existing grocery stores. And finally, to incentivize policy changes that would make it easier for grocery stores to relocate into these communities.
What does a food stamp specialist outreach person do?
Well, part of what I do on the day-to-day is really partner with other nonprofit agencies and social service agencies that are doing great work in our community. Programs ranging from Loaves and Fishes, which is a program of Catholic Charities here in Nashville that feeds the homeless, to everyone from Project Return, which is an organization here in town that works to assist with the reentry process for folks who are recently incarcerated. So part of my job is making connections with those organizations and their programs to make sure that their clients are receiving benefits if they qualify and if they have any questions, being able to help them navigate the system, because I think people underestimate just how complicated it can be to apply for benefits. They ask you for everything from, you know, I like to joke, from, you know, your Social Security number to your mother's maiden name, right? It's pretty an interesting and really intensive process, which isn't easy for all folks. And so part of my job is to be a resource to the community about the program, but also to promote it and help people navigate that complex system.
Well, I'm glad you're there in Nashville. I'm also glad that you told us you're from Chicago, because you didn't sound like you had been on the Grand Ole Opry.
I'm a northern girl who calls the South home now, but I do miss my Chicago-style pizza.
I bet. Jennifer, one more question, and you may have answered it when you said that you had just been ordained. This is not an easy job. You see people that are bound to get to your heart, and you feel for them. What makes you get up in the morning and go do that job?
Well, I mean, I reflect on that scripture in Matthew 25, right, where Jesus says that, you know, when you clothe the naked, feed the hungry, you're doing it for me as well as the least of these. And having accepted my call to ministry at a relatively young age and recently been ordained in the AME Church, I really see this work as my ministry.
Yeah.
And I know that we often think about ministry as being confined to the four walls of the church, but at least for my reading of the gospel, I find that more often than not, Jesus was among the people, working and living in solidarity with them. And so that's what gets me up in the morning. It's knowing that there are people in need, and that to some extent, you know, getting to know them on a very real level and help them recognize their own agency is just such a powerful inspiration to my own personal faith. And if I can do something that'll help alleviate some of the stress, then I am more than happy to do so.
Jennifer Bailey is the Food Stamp Outreach Specialist at Community Food Advocates in Nashville, Tennessee. On this Thanksgiving weekend, it's essential that we recommit to ensuring that none are left out of the bounty of this nation. Jennifer, thank you for what you do, and thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for your mission and passion in the world. It's really making a difference.
You know the Reverend David Beckman as the longtime head of Bread for the World, an effective initiative for fighting hunger and poverty worldwide. David has been so good to come on State of Belief many times and talk about conditions in the world that we all need to know about, and to set before us challenges that we need to accept. As Washington debates budgets and deficits, one of the most important things to not lose sight of is which programs do the most good. And even as some would argue that foreign aid must take a backseat to domestic priorities, one of the true success stories of recent years has been the remarkable impact of programs aimed at childhood health. And as an activist deeply familiar with the facts and figures of this aid, I'm very pleased to have David Beckman back with us again on State of Belief Radio. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, let's begin with truth. There are a number of myths surrounding foreign aid for children's welfare, and that makes the programs particularly vulnerable in today's budget-cutting environment. Budget hawks claim that a huge part of our spending is foreign aid, but that's not the truth, is it?
No. All the foreign affairs spending that we do is about 1% of the federal budget. Mm. You know, so that includes security aid, that kind of thing. The part of foreign aid that is related to reducing poverty in the world is one half of 1% of our federal budget.
Are we not getting that in the public, David, because...
No, most people, I mean, if you just ask people, most people think 14-15% of the federal budget goes to foreign aid.
Yeah.
I don't know where that comes from. Maybe people mix it up with military spending, but it's been a persistent misunderstanding of Americans. Maybe it goes back to the Marshall Plan when we were mm-hmm. you know, really helping Europe, but... All of the assistance we give to poor countries to help them grow, or to poor people to help them take care of their kids better or be more productive farmers, it all comes to one half of 1% of the federal budget. And if you break it down, say, to what it costs me, all of the U.S. programs around the world that are helping to provide safe water to people who drink dirty water. A lot of them have never tasted a glass of clean water. Yeah. And all of that amounts to about a dollar per American per year.
Good grief.
You know, it's life-saving. It's life-saving. And yeah. My judgment is that the programs that are focused on reducing poverty have actually been remarkably successful. Some of the stories that have led a lot of people in this country to think that foreign aid is wasted, those stories come when the U.S. government sometimes, in effect, is using foreign aid to buy an Air Force base or something. Mm. You know, if they're doing it for security purposes and then they send some people over to try to use that money for schools or something, well, what they're really trying to do is get the Air Force base. And so if it doesn't end up that the education project is all that successful, you know, we shouldn't be so surprised. The programs that are really focused on reducing poverty, they work.
Yeah, and the efficiency of the aid given is very, very good, according to the statistics. We get a lot of bang for our buck. You mentioned the water situation. Talk about another program or two that are just remarkably good in helping us get all we want from our money?
Well, we spend $3 a person to help defeat malaria around the world. And UNICEF recently published some figures that compared to 2000, 400,000 fewer kids will die from malaria around the world this year.
Mm.
And that U.S. has provided major leadership in you know, just distributing bed nets mm-hmm. and teaching people what they can do to combat malaria. Mm. It's not easy in tropical areas, you know, with a lot of water around.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do a lot in general among when you work in poor countries. You know, the average income per person may be something like $400 per person a year. Mm. People are really poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can... For not very much money, you can build a mud brick schoolhouse and put a tin roof on it, and it's transformative. It's a huge change in the life of those people, and it doesn't cost very much money mm-hmm. in terms of the kind of money that we're used to spending in the United States. Not that, I mean, every dollar counts. Bread for the World and the faith community generally have done a lot of work to push to make our foreign aid better. There are things that we can do to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
But we just, a group of 36 faith-based organizations decided this was a good time to send Congress a thank you note. Mm-hmm. You know, this is Catholic Relief Services and Bread for the World and American Jewish World Service, a whole bunch of groups. Uh-huh. And we just decided, you know, Congress is getting beat up all the time. But if you look back over 20 years, Congress has made it possible for our country to be a leader in making this the healthiest generation of children in the history of the world. Uh-huh. It's just stunning that 6 million fewer children will die this year than in 1990. You know, people all around the world work to make that happen. But the fact that the U.S. government has consistently focused some of our foreign assistance on child health has made a huge difference in the world for the better. So we sent Congress a thank you note and then said, for God's sake, don't cut it now.
Well, you know, David, I'm so struck by these myths or lack of knowledge, and I don't mean this in an inappropriate way, but did Congress do all of that accidentally, or did they know how much good they were doing?
Well, I think a lot of it's been people of faith over the years.
Uh-huh.
In the 1980s, early 1980s, during the Reagan years, UNICEF made it clear that with not very much money,
mm-hmm.
we could dramatically reduce child death. So one thing they did was what they call oral rehydration therapy. You know, a lot of the kids who die in developing countries die from diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
They drink dirty water or something, and then they get diarrhea and dehydrate. But if you have little packets of sugar and salt that you put into clean water and give that to the baby, you can keep the baby from dying of diarrhea. That packet costs a dime.
Goodness.
So UNICEF had a number of simple ideas like that in the early 80s, and it was really the faith, especially Bread for the World, but more generally the faith community rallied around that and convinced the U.S. Congress during the 80s to ramp up funding for what were called child survival programs. Those programs have operated all around the world since the 80s,
mm-hmm.
teaching low-income parents some simple things that they can do to keep their kids from dying.
Mm.
And so every day, 5,000 or 6,000 fewer kids die in developing countries than would have died before those programs were launched. And it was people of faith
mm-hmm.
that brought that to their members of Congress. And then in the run-up to the year 2000, it was the churches that rallied around the idea of writing off some of the debts for well-governed poor countries.
Yeah, with Bread for the World being the leader in that.
Well, we chaired the legislative coalition, and as a result of that, I think it's 40 million more kids are in school in Africa. Mm. than were in school in the year 2000, because mm-hmm. we worked so that it wouldn't be just writing off debts for poor country governments, but that it would be Jubilee for poor people, you know, right. that the money would actually get to primary schools and basic health care. And so it's allowed many African countries to provide primary education, public primary schools without tuition, and so families can now send their girls to school. It's been a whole generation of young women are coming out of primary schools. They can read and write, add and subtract. You know, so they're healthy young women. They will be healthier mothers, better farmers. They'll have fewer children. You know, the best way to reduce population growth is to teach a girl how to read and write and add and subtract. It just changes.
Yeah.
She plans her life, and you have fewer babies.
I tell you, I get chills listening to you talk about that kind of progress, and we're talking about real people's lives. You're now involved with a campaign called All God's Children. Will you tell us about that and who's involved?
Yeah, this is this group of 36 faith organizations. It's It's an interfaith working group on foreign assistance, and we've put together this campaign to educate first, just to let members of Congress know mm-hmm. all the good that has been done with relatively little money through development assistance programs, and also to educate the American public. And then the point is to keep them from cutting these programs now. I want to say that, in fact, they, given all their huge threats to everything in the U.S. budget that's got anything to do with people who are struggling, you know, very powerful forces are pushing to cut food stamps, cut foreign aid, cut anything that's got to do with poor people, really, especially things. I mean, they're concerned about the deficit, but disproportionately the attack's been on programs for poor people. But in this area of development assistance, it's been surprising. But in fact, we've been able to see bipartisan pushback. Senator Lindsey Graham and from South Carolina, Senator Dan Coats from Indiana, Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri, they're among the Republican senators who have held the line. And surprisingly, stunningly, these programs that save lives around the world have really been protected from cuts. But, you know, they're on the chopping block again now as they debate the sequester. And so people of faith, other people of goodwill, we need to weigh in and say, for God's sake, you know, these things, these cuts to these programs kill people.
I'm not just are you hopeful, but are you optimistic that the programs will be saved?
Well, nobody knows. We've got to fight for them.
Yeah.
You know, so people can help by writing to their senator, writing to their House member and saying, you know, maintain a circle of protection around programs that are important to hungry and poor people in our own country and around the world.
So, David, you anticipated what I was going to ask you here at the end of what our listeners can do. In just a sentence or two, and this may be redundant, but in a sentence or two, tell our listeners what to write to their members of Congress so that they will be heard on this issue.
So one way to just check in is to go to bread.org. You can write to your member of Congress from Bread for the World's website, bread.org. There are also suggested language that you can adapt. It's important that if people write, they write personal letters. If it just seems like it's a machine that wrote the letter, it won't make much difference.
Right.
And basically what we're saying to members of Congress is that we want them to maintain a circle of protection around programs that provide help and opportunity to poor and hungry people in this country and also around the world.
The Reverend David Beckman is president of Bread for the World and, now listen to this, a World Food Prize laureate. Now, that may sound like something that you get as the winner of America's Top Chef TV program, but it's far, far more important than that. David, you work at the fulcrum of so many in need and so many who have abundance, and your effectiveness at reconciling these two worlds is absolutely remarkable. That's why it is always good to hear from you. So thanks again for joining us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, Alton. I really appreciate your program.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution, a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcast. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. We encourage you to tell others about the show, and we encourage you to have them join the conversation so that we can extend this thing across the nation. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, well.